Well, John. All right. This is the third in the series of our lessons. We'll have one more tomorrow. I'll have a fair amount of information. I have a lot of information tomorrow. But one of the things, there's so much more that can be said than what we're going to say in these days. Someone mentioned Ezekiel chapter 37 yesterday, the Valley of Bones. I think Haley called that a resurrection of cause. In other words, you know, things are looking really bad for Israel, but God's going to breathe life back into them. And so you have language like that and other places. But there are many passages. There are a couple in Revelation I'll not take time to talk about unless that happens to come up tomorrow. And some things that are in there. But as we go through this, we're looking at the fundamental evidence of the reality that Jesus lived, he died, was buried, and raised on the third day. And so as we go forward this morning, Jesus, during the course of his ministry, said that he would die, he would suffer at the hands of these evil men, he would die, and that he would raise again from the dead. So he talks about his death, burial, and resurrection. And so this morning, that will be the theme of our study, is basically what Jesus said during the course of his ministry and the implications of that. In the book of Luke chapter 24, after Jesus has been raised from the dead, this chapter begins upon the first day of the week. And in Luke chapter 24, the women have come to the tomb, and then Peter runs over and finds that things are just like he said. And then as the chapter turns, if I ever get to, I think I've got Luke 24 in this Bible. I love this little testament because I can read the print, but the pages are hard to turn, so thank you for your patience. But down in Luke chapter 24 and verse 13, it talks about two of the disciples that have been at Jerusalem, and now they are walking 7 miles to a town called Emmaus. And along their walk, another person joins himself to them. It says in verse 15, it came about that while they were conversing and discussing, Jesus himself approached and began traveling with them. But you notice verse 16, what does it tell us that's unique here? They didn't recognize him. Now, does that mean that after he was raised, his form and appearance was different, so they couldn't recognize him? What do you see? Their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. And because there's lots of material here, I'll go ahead and mention this. When you get down to verse 31, sort of at the end of this exchange, they're going to be eating together. In verse 31, and their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. So I'm going to call this a miraculous event where Jesus comes to them, and he's walking along, and he's asking questions. And they say, are you the only one around that doesn't know these events that have been going on? So what events? And so then they start telling him what's going on. And so it says down in verse 24, and some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just exactly as the women also had said, but him they did not see. And he said to them, O foolish men and slow to heart, to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. Now stop and just think a minute. Who do they think they are talking to? Just some guy, some friend they're walking along with. And so they're saying, okay, here's what happened. And the women found this tomb empty out there. And this person says, what's wrong with you all? You're slow to believe all that the prophets spoke. And then in verse 26, was it not necessary for the Messiah to suffer, for the Christ to suffer these things, and to enter into glory? Yesterday in our charts, we talked about the ascension. In Daniel 7, and you see the glory. We go to John 17, and in his prayer, glorify thou me with the glory which I had with thee before all this, if you would, from eternity. And so he entered into glory. And that's really what the scriptures say. And in verse 27, and beginning with Moses and with all the prophets. And so we spent time talking about the scriptures yesterday, but I intentionally avoided this. And so what happens is Jesus starts with Moses and the prophets explaining the things concerning himself in all the scriptures. And they approached the village where they were going, and he acted as though he would go farther. And they urged him, saying, stay with us, for it's getting toward evening, and the day is now nearly over. And he went in to stay with them. Now, this doesn't have anything to do with this, but just the thoughts popping into my head. We mentioned somewhere in our comments about hospitality. Here's hospitality and entertaining of strangers. It wasn't an angel this time. Let me suggest to you, when you show this kind of hospitality, sometimes it opens doors in your life or some comfort or some lifelong friend that had I failed to warmly reach out and invite them into my world, I would have missed. I think that's a very warming thought. And so they invite this man in. And as they invite him in verse 30, it came about that when he had reclined at the table with them, he took the bread and blessed it, and breaking it, he began giving it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. And so now, you know, it's getting towards evening, they're eating, and all of a sudden, Jesus is talking about all these scriptures, and they are deeply engaged. He vanishes. What do they do next? Go to bed and think about that all night? They head back to Jerusalem. And so they head back to Jerusalem. They said to one another, were not our hearts burning within us while he was speaking to us on the road, while he was explaining the scriptures to us? So they rose that very hour, returned to Jerusalem, and found gathered together the 11, those who were with them, saying, the Lord has really risen and has appeared to Simon. And they began to relate their experiences on the road and how he was recognized by them in the breaking of the bread. And while they were still telling these things, he himself stood in their midst. So the doors are locked, they're bolted, got a bar across it probably. And all of a sudden, boom, here's Jesus. After he was eating with these men in Emmaus, he vanishes. And so as we look at these particular events, they are pretty amazing. The resurrection is mentioned a lot of times. Pardon me. Someone said that one of the issues with people who deny the resurrection is they deny the obvious things. The common denominator with these false teachers is they deny the empty tomb. But the tomb was empty as we go forward. As we think about the resurrection, I want to ask this question: how early did Jesus state that he would be killed and raised from the dead? When you consider scriptures like John chapter 2, you remember in John chapter 2, you've got several things, but the turning over the tables, the money changers, those kinds of things, the first time. And then at the end of his ministry, he does it again. So this is early in his ministry. And it says in verse 18, the Jews then said to him, what sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things? As he turned over the money changers. Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. The Jews then said, it took 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking of the temple of his body. So when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken. They believed the scripture and the word Jesus had spoken. And so as you notice this, you remember in John, the 16th chapter, the Holy Spirit was going to guide the apostles into all the truth. In chapter 14 also, it talks about those things. And he's going to bring to remembrance all that I said. As we look at this, the disciples remember, way back early on, he was talking about this. And so here in John chapter 2, early on, he is expressing this. In Matthew chapter 12, he's going to talk about the sign of Jonah. And let me just, let's do it this way so I don't just keep talking. What is this text about when he talks about no sign will be given you except the sign of Jonah? So what's going on here?
They're asking for a sign from heaven.
Okay, they're asking for a sign from heaven. Have they been buying into him at this point? No, they're amazed at the miraculous things that he's doing. And they can't deny the clear, concise miracles, and so they attribute to Beelzebul. Because they're happening, so if we buy into what he's saying, then that's one thing. So we want to deny that, and so what do you do? You come up with an alternate plan, even though it's wrong, it's false, it's not true, and he responds to that. But he has been doing miracles already, and he continues to do miracles. You go back earlier in Matthew, and after the Sermon on the Mount, the next two chapters, 8 and 9, there's a whole bunch of miracles showing that I have authority. So he's demonstrating, and he's doing these many miracles, but they want something done in their own way. They want God to speak from heaven or some unique thing in that way. And the evidence is given. By the way, did Jesus say, not do any more miracles after this? No, he did more miracles. But here's the sign. And the sign is Jonah. So what is the sign? What's the sign of Jonah? What's that?
Raised
in 3 days. As Jonah was in the belly of the great fish and then spewed out on the ground, the Son of Man will be in the belly of the earth and been brought forth from that. And so that's going to be the sign of Jonah. Now, how critical is this statement? Yes, sir. Okay, very good. We'll come to that after a bit. That's a very good point. Yeah. So back, this is where I'm going with this question, and I did not clearly express it. But in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 18, verse 21 and 22, it talks about there that God tells Moses, I'm going to raise a prophet like of you from among your brethren. Everyone who does not listen to him will be cut off from God's people. That's quoted over in Acts chapter 3. And so very definitely we know what it's about. I love when God gives us the commentary in the New Testament, what he said before, that helps me avoid at least some mistakes. I still probably make some in trying to sort that out. But that's a great thing. But the very end of this text in Deuteronomy chapter 18, and I did 10, 15 years ago, did a lesson called The Prophet. And part of that is really centered around Deuteronomy chapter 18. If a man says that he is speaking from God, and yet what he says does not come true, does not come to pass, then you can ignore him, because he is not my prophet. And so when Jesus makes this powerful, clear, concise expression about that he's going to be killed and raised, the sign of Jonah, he puts all the cards on the table. And if this does not happen, you can just write all this off. This is critical. This is critical. The text reads this way. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees said to him, Teacher, we want to see a sign from you. And he answered and said unto them, An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign. And yet no sign will be given it, but the sign of Jonah the prophet. And just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, the great fish, whatever, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, someone greater than Jonah is here. Talk about a suitcase to unpack. I mean, there is wonderful things in here. But you see their responsibility and the response to that. And there's a lot that could be said about Jonah in this situation. A little later in Matthew, in chapter 16, in verse 4, it says, An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and a sign will not be given except the sign of Jonah. And he left them and went away. You can look at Luke 11, Mark chapter 8, and see more where it talks about this sign of Jonah. And so if the thing does not come to pass, Deuteronomy 18:21 says this, if a thing does not come about or come true, that he's not from God. Verse 21, you may say in your heart, how will we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? And when a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not come about and come true, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. In other words, that came from him, not from God. You shall not be afraid of him. And so Jesus, again, he banks everything on this. And so that's critical. Well, as we go forward here just a little bit, in the book of Matthew, the 16th chapter, Matthew chapter 16. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you. Now, I put down here in yellow, you may remember some kind of a confession in chapter 16. What was that? That's right. So here is the confession. And then later, you remember Jesus says, upon this rock I will build my church. That's just before this statement. Again, how this unfolds is not what the disciples have in mind. But Jesus is being very clear. So here is later in his ministry, but not at the end of his ministry. And he's you know, reintroducing these very things. So Jesus began to show them what would happen. This is probably about three-fourths of a year before the crucifixion, is what J.W. McGarvey puts it in chronological time, give or take. But still, it is a while before what we're going to be looking at here in just a minute. In chapter 17 and verse 12, but I say to you that Elijah already came, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he had spoken to them about John the Baptist. But in the midst of that, he says, they're going to do this stuff to me. A little bit further along at the Mount of Transfiguration, it says in verse 22, he gives this prediction that he'll be killed and raised on the third day. Verse 22, and while they were gathering together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And he'll be raised on the third day, and they were deeply grieved. And so you see these passages over here on the left side of the screen. And in chapter 17, verse 22, again, as we just read, chapter 20, as Jesus was about to go to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves. And on the way, he said to them, behold, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and will hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge, to crucify him, and on the third day, he will be raised up. And in chapter 20 here, in verse 20, just following this is when James and John's mother requests that her sons can sit at the left and right when he comes in his kingdom. In Luke chapter 18, they did not comprehend these things that were said. And it tells us again in verse 31, then he took the 12 aside and said to them. So this tells us the same thing that we just read here. And so Jesus here is telling them this again and again and again. And so by the end, before the crucifixion, they get it. Is that right? No. What hindered them from understanding this? What's that? Okay, they're not getting the resurrection part of it. Brent?
It's not an accident that Peter rebuking Jesus about this comes in the same chapter that he was confessing to Christ, because that was a bold and faith-filled
fulfill the statement, but unfortunately, he was confessing, you are the Christ that I have always expected.
Okay, very good. Yeah.
And him dying was not part of any, didn't have anything to do with being the Christ that Peter expected.
Very good. And that's really the point I want to make here. I want you to think about that. I want me to think about that. Sometimes my preconceived ideas get in the way of the truth of staring at the scriptures right at me. And so I have to be careful. And it is a human challenge to try to push that aside and go to the text and understand what's there. So we struggle with that as people. But you see that here. They had a concept and a perception of things that was different than the reality that God in Christ was unfolding. And so they're not getting it. I'm sure there are other things involved with it too. As well. You know, we love you, you can't go. I mean, there's things like that, as in this chapter Brent just mentioned. But basically, what you see, these statements are made again and again. And as I have at the bottom here, make no mistakes about it, this is coming. And so he nails this thing down several times. Now to our brother, Joe's comments a moment ago. Again and again, what happens is in Matthew 16, 17, 20, 27, and he'll be raised up on the third day, and he'll be raised up on the third day, and on the third day he will be raised. After 3 days, I am to rise again, verse 66. And the soldiers go and make the grave secure along with the guard. They set a seal on the stone down here at the bottom. So when that happens in this last text, he is there, that tomb is secured, it has a seal, it has a guard. When you go make it as secure as you can, that's pretty secure. And for us, looking back at evidences, that's a pretty good thing. That is a weighty evidence as a piece of this whole that we see. But again, it's not just any day, but the third day. And so, as was mentioned a moment ago, if it had been the second day or the fourth day or the sixth day or something like that, on the third day he will be raised. The sign of Jonah on the third day. This is exactly as God had prepared, planned, determined, and it unfolded just like he said that it would, because it was the Word of God. It was the will of God. And it was by the power of God this thing would be carried through and carried out. All recognized there is an empty tomb. Jesus is very open about this. His disciples have heard this. Others have heard this. The Jewish leaders have heard this. By this time, Pilate's going to hear this. And so there's no question, you know, the word is out. It's not like Jesus over here in the corner, you know, spoke, well, I may, you know, happens. This is out in their face. As I said, all the cards are on the table. But what we find is there was an empty tomb. Now, this is something I probably pulled this information from Lee Strobel, who does the case for the Christ. He didn't make this chart, but I think I probably took the information from that. And it's just a diagram that says that either the tomb was occupied or it was empty. So if it was occupied, then, you know, here are some possible explanations. You know, it was just a tomb, nobody knew where it was at. Or they went to the wrong tomb. Of course, as you see, the witnesses, they all watched where he was buried. And they come back to the tomb, and the clothes are folded in there. And, you know, this just doesn't work. Some would try to discount the resurrection, saying, well, you know, it was just a legend. Well, there's lots of documentation, not only in the scriptures, but outside the fact that this Jesus lived, that he was crucified, he was killed, and so the Romans, outside of this, in giving certain reports, that has been preserved. The evidence is there, and the legend doesn't work. The spiritual resurrection, there are some who deny miracles, and so say, well, you know, he just spiritually Well, you got this whole argument in here. The tomb was empty. This wasn't a philosophy or his influence or something, as we mentioned early on. Or hallucinations. Well, all these people just hallucinated this. Well, people know anything about hallucinations. That's not how hallucinations work. Now, I may have one, but that doesn't mean Brent and John and, you know, everybody else is going to. That's not the way they work. So the bottom line is all this is just nonsense. And there is a ton of material out there. Apologetics Press writes some things from time to time on such evidence as Lee Strobel. There's evidence that demands a verdict. There's a ton of material out there. This has been written about. Lawyers of great minds. Sometimes people who don't really even care about the Bible, but from a historical perspective, they look at the evidence and it brings them to a place where this evidence, there's one conclusion. The evidence. Well, the tomb was empty. And so you could put in here natural causes, stole by the disciples. Well, as you read the text, that doesn't work out. Moved by the authorities. Well, the disciples and this movement saying Jesus raised from the dead, they just had to produce the body. They didn't do that. That some would say, and this is really pretty stupid, it was a swoon theory. Well, Jesus was suffering up there and they took him off the cross and he wasn't really dead. And when they put him in the cool of the tomb, he revived and off he went. They don't know anything about Roman crucifixion. These guys were professionals. And by the way, that spear is going to sort of interrupt your swoon, isn't it? You see what's happening when people try to explain away, and some talk about the Passover plot. Well, there's just some guy, he was going to take these prophecies and try to make them work for him. And this is just all nonsense. Because they reject the facts and the evidence that the tomb was empty. The disciples and the enemies and none of these folks took the body. But he was raised just like he said that he would be. And then he didn't just ascend to heaven. Acts chapter 1, he spent 40 days. And he brought forth evidence and witnesses to that evidence. And so as we look at this supernatural matter, that there was a bodily resurrection, Jesus is risen. He was raised from the dead. Now here's a list of the appearances. After Jesus has been crucified and he raises from the dead, he appears to Mary Magdalene, the other women. Again, you're welcome to these slides. If you got a thumb drive or whatever, put it on. I've got a Mac, so I can do AirDrop if you got Mac stuff. To the other women, to Cleopas and his companion on the way to Emmaus, to Simon Peter, to the apostles except Thomas. And all these occurred in Jerusalem, as you can see down here, within the first week after the resurrection. To the seven at the Sea of Tiberias, up at the Sea of Galilee. To the apostles on a mountain in Galilee, giving the Great Commission in Matthew chapter 28. To James, the Lord's brother, in 1 Corinthians 15. At Jerusalem again to the apostles, another reminder of the commission. In Luke 24 and in Acts chapter 1 we see. After leading the apostles to the Mount of Olives near Bethany at the time of his ascension. And so they're with him, they're walking with him, he's going to go out there and he's going to ascend. And then after the ascension, he appears to Saul on the road to Damascus. Now, is there something in there that I missed? Is there some 500 witnesses? In 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And in 1 Corinthians 15, it doesn't mention the women. And comments go sort of this way, that the women were there. Had you made the story up, you wouldn't have written them in the text as the witnesses because they were not considered valid witnesses in that time. That's just the attitude towards women. And so they thought, well, they are fickle, unreliable, so they are not solid witnesses. But these women witnessed what happened. In 1 Corinthians 15, he doesn't include them. He just says some other things because he's trying to reach a different audience and say, look, here's plenty of evidence. And that's what you're after. It's not intended to tell everything from A to Z that happened. It's intended to lay out the evidence sufficiently so that the eyewitnesses are there. This happened. And you can know it. Most of those 500 people are still alive. What's the implication of that? Well, some are not, so it's been a period of time. But what's the significance of that? Most of them are still alive. If you aren't, you can go talk to the witnesses. Now, let's be frank. If I have three witnesses, that's enough to verify something according to law, mouth of two or three witnesses. If I have 10 witnesses, I mean, that's pretty good. If I have 50 witnesses, I mean, that's more, but that's sort of overkill. And you get 500 in there, I mean, that's over the top. But the thing is, this matter of the resurrection of Christ and the verification of this resurrection, as we said at the beginning, is a critical matter. And this evidence is deep and broad and wide. I've got also in Acts chapter 10, verse 39, where he talks about being witnesses and all. This comes from Strobel. The nature of witnesses, as we think about the apostles and these other witnesses, there were many of them. They exhibited good character. The change seen in the people on the post-resurrection side from fleeing when they walked away from Jesus when he was betrayed to standing, to the point that each one of these, saving seemingly John, died holding fast this testimony. Now, a lot of people will die for a lie. You look at history, many people have a cause and they're willing to die for it. But the thing is, they have been deceived or have believed something is false, something that is a lie. But what we have here is these men are eyewitnesses. It's not just something they heard or learned or false that they heard and they bought into and got carried away by. But they saw with their own eyes that this Jesus is the Messiah, that God raised from the dead. And every one of them stood fast and held strong to the testimony, we will not lie. This is what happened. To the point that they suffered in all kinds of various ways. It cost them their life. They were martyrs. They were witnesses to the point of death. Casey.
How Watergate enrolled 12 of the most powerful men in the world, and they couldn't keep alive for 3 weeks. Then you're telling me that 12 apostles could keep alive for 40 years.
Okay.
Absolutely impossible.
Very good. That's a great point. And lots of things could be stated like that. Very, very good. Okay. So as we move on here, before the clock does, you see the change in the people. We know that the apostles who took this testimony to the point of dying for the truth without any ever changing that testimony. And then the next generation gave testimony to these truths as well. And I've got this quote again from Strobel about Ignatius. And so he died in 117. So that's right after this, overlapping with the apostles and the next generation. And so he was a bishop of Antioch, died in 117. He was arrested in Antioch of Syria. He was drugged to Rome and killed by wild beasts under the rule of Trajan. The epistles of Ignatius, the early church fathers, in those Ignatius wrote. Of course, this is not inspired. He didn't intend it. It's just a letter. It's a historical document. And in that, he makes this statement. Jesus was really and truly born. Jesus was really, truly baptized by John the Baptist. Jesus really, truly performed miracles, was really, truly crucified, not just in appearance, really, truly laid in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, really, truly rose from the dead. Because of Jesus, because Jesus did really truly raise from the dead, Ignatius knew that he would someday raise also. These are not imaginations, myths, or legends, but rather really truly happened. A powerful thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, after we talk about the apostles and James the Lord's brother and more than 500 witnesses that he appeared to, that Paul says, and then as a child untimely born, he appeared to me. I had a couple good friends. They're both dead now. They lived out in the Northwest, and they studied Hebrew together from a Jew. And one of the things that he told them was that this has puzzled us Jews all through the centuries, this transition in Paul's life. There is a statement in Jewish writings, I understand, where the statement is made about Gamaliel, that when Gamaliel died, the glory of the law died with him. That was an expression that he was just a great, over-the-top teacher. Many of the Jews looked at Paul that he would be the next Gamaliel. And yet, in the midst of all of that, he did a 180 turn from getting permission and persecuting and trying to force Christians to blaspheme to standing in the forefront of their ranks. And so that impresses me. The Jews are saying, man, this doesn't make sense. We don't understand. Why would he do that? I did a sermon one time. Three or four deaths of Paul. He died in sin. And of course, you die spiritually. And then he physically died, but in between, the day in Acts chapter 9 where Saul realized rather than charging forward doing the will of God, he was charging forward facing against God. And to a man who was trying to be righteous and to please and to serve God, and at that moment in Acts chapter 9, he realizes, this God I'm trying to please and serve, I've been his enemy. It would kill you inside. I think we gloss over the magnitude of that occasion. But what comes out of that, what unfolds from that, is that you have a man that is fully convinced and convicted, and from that, the job that God gives him, he goes forward until finally he has run the course, finished the faith. He's being poured out like a drink offering. It's over. That's really the impact that the resurrection of Jesus Christ should have upon us. That it changes everything. And it should be seen in the priorities of my life. If I'm going to be a preacher, it's not I'm going to be a big man. I'm going to get all these books. I'm going to get my name on the internet. And I'm going to do all this blogging and everybody's going to know me. That's so far away from what a preacher of the gospel of Christ should be. It's night and day different than what you see, for example, in the Apostle Paul. I count all that nonsense as rubbish. I'm God's servant. And I'm going to get after it. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is that powerful evidence. Little side note, I love when he was caught up to the third heaven. I don't understand much about that. I don't know for sure where that was, when he was stoned or in Damascus or whatever, somewhere in that time frame. But it seems reasonable to me, and that's, understand, this is my comment, that God allowed him to see the glories of what this is all about in such a way to help reinforce where he was. And when you see him, it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. That's not just a nice saying you put on the plaque and put on the wall. It is the transforming power of the resurrected Messiah. And so as we look at Paul, we see his conversion. That is a powerful, powerful evidence. And you look at Acts chapter 8 and 9 and you know chapter 22 and chapter 26, and you see this complete turnaround. But what did the brothers of Jesus think of Jesus during the course of his ministry? What's that? Yeah, they didn't believe. Matter of fact, the people are crowded around, they come up, they say, "These guys lost his mind. What's going on here?" But we have two New Testament letters apparently that were written by his brothers. And in Acts chapter 1, when they're in the upper, the family is there. What appears to be a transitioning point is the resurrection from the dead. Now, there may be more other influences at the end of his ministry and some things I don't know about. But there is a marked difference when Jesus is raised from the dead. It changes everything. And so as we look at this, we can look at these passages like John chapter 7, where they didn't believe, and we see them together in John or in Acts chapter 1, verse 14. And then here I've got a bunch of verses in yellow in Acts chapter 12, 15, 21, and so forth. You got James, the Lord's brother. He is, if you would, a leader in the church. Now what happens with other revolutions? A man dies, and what do? They look around next, okay, who's going to be our leader? That's not what James became. I mean, he would be a good candidate. Well, he was near Jesus. He was his brother. No. What's James doing? He's seeing my half-brother Jesus is the Son of God. And he's raised from the dead. And I'll live and serve and I'll die because I believe that. The evidence convicted me. And that's who I am. I'm a servant of the Messiah, who is God's servant. And so as we look at that, I mean, that is a weighty transition. And again, it's not a change of having your name over here on some paper and having your name put here. It is the transformation of a life and a purpose and a testimony to the world about you. And it is powerful. And then I mentioned, I think, yesterday, In Acts, we are witnesses. Acts chapter 1 and verse 8. And I use an illustration to talk about that. They were with Jesus from the time of his baptism to his ascension. You aren't going to fool them. They knew who he was. You couldn't bring in an imposter or anything else. You know, God closed that all in a very tight way. And again, you see that here in these passages. The amazing speed and the extent associated with the growth of Christianity after the resurrection of Jesus. You see what happens, and it happens in the midst of opposition. I really think it's easy for me to take for granted how big of a deal it was for a Jew to become a Christian and to set aside the Judaism that's been his whole life. And family members who didn't buy in the kind of division and difference and change that caused in their life. We can easily just say, okay, yeah. But it was difficult. And again, I'm doing this by conjecture, and so you always got to be careful with that. That gets you in trouble. But when you have all these poor saints in Jerusalem, I'm not sure why, but a very reasonable possibility is that now they have become Christians and they're on the outs with their Jew, the fellow Jews here. And it creates a whole new dilemma. But what you see in that is the depth of the conviction, and what's it going to cost me? Whatever it is, I will pay. Why? Because my Lord, God's Messiah, who is the Son of God, raised from the dead. And this is worth everything. That's the power of the resurrection of the Messiah in me. The resurrection saturates the teaching and the preaching in the book of Acts. As you go through, and what I did is I did a search about resurrection and raised, a Boolean search, so get those. But again and again and again and again, in their preaching, the Messiah, Jesus, the Messiah, has been raised from the dead. In Acts chapter 2, we talked about it. This demonstrates, just like Psalm 110 talked about, He is Lord and Christ. He is the Messiah, this Jesus that you crucified. And let all of the house of Israel know, what's that other word in there? For certain. Why do you know for certain? The evidence is like an avalanche, like a tsunami. The evidence is powerfully overwhelming. Well, I'm about out of time, so we want to talk for just a second about John chapter 20. John chapter 20. It's really too bad when I don't follow my notes. In John chapter 20, verse 26 through 29, there are some other things I'd like to have incorporated a while ago that I just missed out on, but we'll talk about some of that tomorrow. When Jesus manifests himself alive, he demonstrated that he had this physical body and that he ate. And as we look here in John chapter 20, we see that Jesus appears to the apostles, but Thomas is not with them. And then a week later, he appears to them again, and Thomas is with them. When they tell Thomas that the Lord appeared, what's his response in this chapter? What's it? Yeah, get real. Yeah, I'm not going to believe unless what? Unless I can be there and I can put my hands in those scars, in his hands, in his side, and with my eyes, I can see him. Now, I'm thankful that the Lord saw fit to put this text in here. Because Thomas says, I want the proof. And so Jesus appears, and what does he say? After 8 days, which would be a week later, I think some translations translated a week later. The disciples were inside and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and stood in their midst, and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, reach here with your finger and see my hands, and reach here your hand and put it into my side, and do not be unbelieving, but believing. Thomas answered and said unto him, my Lord and my God. And Jesus said to him, because you have seen me and you have believed, blessed are they who did not see and yet believed. Now there's an interesting thing here. There are people who do not buy into the deity of Jesus. And they say when it talks about, you know, that he is a God, that they put it with a little g. And in other texts, you know, the article is not in there. Took a picture out of my interlinear. The Lord of me and the God of me. That's the confession. You are my king, and you are God. Evidence that demands the verdict. Jesus is the Messiah, and won't he be my king and Lord? I think I mentioned this previously. There was a fellow in Sierra Leone. He died here just a few months ago. But in his comments, he said, Jesus is my Lord and reigning King. And I just love the depth and the color of that genuine expression. And so is that who Jesus is in my life? The evidence is there to bring us to that point. Blessed are you because you have seen and believe. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Well, why believe? Because the evidence moves us. The weekend that changed or affected time and eternity the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. To God be the glory. Thank you.
I need 4 strong males to haul some water, because I'm not doing it.
Need 4 strong guys to carry flats of water in. See Tommy. Thanks.
I see